Greet each one in Jesus' name. I do stand a bit in trembling this morning, but maybe not so much trembling because it's a difficult subject, but because it's such a practical subject and it's a difficult one, knowing my propensities to live out. I invite you to turn to the book of James, chapter 1. The title this morning is "The Tongue is a Fire." If you get the Lebanon Daily News, you saw that phrase in bold headlines recently. It was featuring a story of a church that I gathered nearly closed its doors because of people and the use of words. And it's not every day that the newspaper uses a direct Bible quote for its headline. And it just sort of stuck. The tongue is a fire. You know, fire is something that we appreciate. It does service. I'm glad for fire. It saves me a lot of garbage hauling out to the dumpster, because I can just take it to the burn barrel, and that disintegrates it down to, with the help of fire, to probably a couple handful of ashes. It's nice. But there have been times that the burn barrel was a bit overflowing and some fire got on the wrong side. And then it became very concerning because fire is fire and it was not contained. The tongue can be a controlled burn that can be well used for the kingdom and beautiful for the kingdom, or it could be an uncontrolled burn that leaves trails of chaos, ruin of many people's lives, reputation, and sadly sometimes the testimony of the church of Jesus Christ. This morning, I like to believe that there are likely many people across our nation that are oscillating between amusement and disgust as they see the power of the tongue playing out, the power of communication playing out on a personal and national level. It amazes me again how people can debate and they can cut each other down, and yet somehow at the end of the day, if one emerges as being the favorite, they can then somehow rally that that person is a value after all. It's the way the election process works, and the tongue is used to try and get to the top, to try and be the winner. And we can see how words influence and words change course. So because of things that are said, a rudder that seemed to be set one way, it seems like suddenly the ship can start going a different direction because of the power of words. Well, James gives us some warning that the same dilemma that is happening in the world around us can happen in the church, can happen to ourselves if we're not careful. We can be a very religious people, but if we don't know how to talk about each other, don't know how to handle that little tongue of ours, we can do a lot of ruin. James 1 and verse 26. I'd like to read that. Very familiar verse. It says, I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong chapter. If any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, that man's religion is vain. Our tongue has a lot to tell about us, of the depth of our faith, our religion. Then go back to chapter 3. I'd like to read verses 5 and 6. Even so the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body and setteth on fire the course of nature and is set on fire of hell. Now, partly what got me to feel directed to talk on this morning was something that I read that it just arrested my attention. There was a man by the name of John Saddington a number of years ago. I'm not sure exactly when he did his survey, but he had connections and somehow he could reach out to Google and did some kind of search of the why questions that are directed toward various religious groups. And he tried to find out the top 10 most used words of people that were trying to ask some why questions about a particular religion. Every religion develops some serious stereotypes that people observe enough to maybe make them curious, enough to wonder why this religious group does this way or acts this way, what is behind it. And what he did, he tried to find out what words were people Googling to try and understand various religious cultures. So he did that, and what he searched for is the why are questions. The why are. Why are Muslims so? Or why are Jews so? Or why are Christians so? And he wanted to see what that word is that they put in that they were looking for to try and discover why they're so. Now I'm going to, first of all, read the top 10 that he found relating to Jewish people. Why are the Jews so cheap? Why are the Jews so successful? Why are the Jews so smart? Why are the Jews so rich? Why are the Jews so greedy? Why are the Jews so annoying? Why are the Jews so hated? Why are the Jews so ugly? Why are the Jews so liberal? Why are the Jews so funny? Those were the top 10 words that people were using to try and understand what they knew about the Jews and why it was that way. And for Muslims, there were words like violent and stupid and angry and crazy and sensitive and hateful and intolerant and backward and evil and extreme. But thankfully for the Christians, they were all nice words, right? Do you want to know what the list was for the Christians? Why are Christians so stupid? Why are Christians so judgmental? Why are Christians so ignorant? Why are Christians so hateful? Why are Christians so intolerant? Why are Christians so mean? Why are Christians so narrow-minded? Why are Christians so hypocritical? Why are Christians so annoying? Why are Christians so crazy? Now, as Christians, we would wish that the top searches would have had more words like, why are Christians so compassionate? Why are Christians so forgiving? Why are Christians so generous? Why are Christians so dedicated to their faith? We don't like those words, mean and hypocritical and judgmental, some of those in that list there. But this morning, as Christians, we do face a challenging dynamic. Because we are on the one hand commanded to love and show forth graces that are endearing. But on the other hand, we are called to stand for causes that run counter to Main Street thinking, Main Street values. And this can create a complicated scenario. And we can get stereotyped that in ways that we can understand why society would search for those words many. Not all the labels are wrong in and of themselves. As I pondered the one narrow-minded. Narrow-minded, why are Christians so narrow-minded? Well, if we're not going to be on the broad way and we're going to be on the narrow way, then I guess we will have to be, in some respects, rather narrow-minded, because what's out there is not for us. It's not what we are looking into, even. I can't claim to be a toll road junkie, but choose 322 as my favorite road to travel. It's one or the other. Either I do like toll roads, and if I do, then I'll use them. So the word narrow-minded in and of itself is almost maybe unescapable in some respects if we're going to be a Christian. When a salesman has a product to sell me that he is convinced I need, but I don't think I need or want, he will maybe get the label annoying. He might get that label because I don't want anything to do with what he has to offer, and yet he's convinced that I need it, and he can come and become annoying very fast because he's doing his job. He's trying to convince me, and I don't want it. So the word annoying comes up really fast. We, for good cause, are asked by our commander-in-chief, Jesus Christ, to be in the world, but not of the world. We are asked to not run with the world to the same excess of riot. And to live that out, this means that we'll have to form some conclusions. We'll have to set some boundaries to what constitutes the world or to what constitutes excess as the world would do it. And we don't want to do it that way. This means we have to, in doing that, this means we might appear judgmental. It might feel like to those around us that we're just thinking we're better than them, and we're judging them, and where they set their lines, we're putting a judgment on that. We're saying, no, you didn't set it at the right place. Here's where we're setting it. We may appear to believe we have it figured out better than a neighbor does, or that they have gone too far. Even though they claim the title Christian, they've gone too far. Maybe we feel it would be a poor use of kingdom resources to do some of the things that our neighbors do. Very likely there are some of those things. We feel it could send mixed signals to engage in that to those around us that are observing us. As a Christian businessman, there are some things that I chose to set boundaries on because I serve Jesus. And it fits too closely to the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eye, and I just don't feel that I can do it. I try and be kind, but sometimes we have to stand. So what about this search? What about these words that the world was using most to search out Christians and try and understand them? Do we have any part to play? Do we have any part to play in them going on a search with those kind of words? I think this morning that we have a large part to play. How we use our tongue, how we represent Christ. But I believe one of the more convincing things as the world is getting to see Christianity at work on a more open platform, the world is seeing that Christians can exchange some pretty harsh language toward each other as they see the Facebook open up, as they see blogs, as they see Twitter and other social media venues. And the Christians are freely going at it, so to speak, on there, misrepresenting one another, even blocking one another. Is it any wonder that the world says, aren't these Christian people? Why are Christians so mean? Why are they so mean? The world is seeing a people who profess to follow Jesus, the Prince of Peace, but become uncivil in their personal relationships with each other. And it's becoming more noticeable to the world. Now, civil disagreement and even debate, if you want to call it that, when done in the spirit of Christ, it can be healthy and helpful. It is a part of church life. It is a part of being a Christian. It is a part of learning to know each other on deeper levels and to explore core values and to have our values explored to make sure that we are coming out at sound doctrine. But when we let our differences in perspective descend into second-guessing motives and distortions of another's words and mischaracterization of another's views and maybe even personal attacks on them, then we moved into the realm of the flesh. We moved into the realm of the flesh. We have to be honest. We did. And it's not a good use of our tongue. It's not a good use of language that God has gifted us with. The bottom line is usually that the name of Jesus gets tarnished in some way, sometimes in a small way. I already had to make an apology because of some stresses in relating that I know that I responded carnally. I knew I did. It was not from a heart of love, but it was from a heart of frustration. Now, I like to hope that way underneath was love, but frustration was above love at the moment. It should concern us if we are stereotyped as mean and hypocritical more frequently than words such as loving and gracious. When those kind of words appear more rarely, it should concern us. James Hunter makes a powerful statement when he says, "If Christians cannot extend grace within the body of believers, they will not be able to extend grace to those outside." And I think there's a lot of truth to his statement. The Bible is clear. How we relate to each other speaks powerfully to the world. It molds their view of the one who we are calling ourselves after, naming ourselves after. We call ourselves little Christ. John 13 and 35 is very clear when it says, "By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye stand up for your doctrine, how you believe it, and browbeat and manipulate your brother in vicious arguments till he bows or leaves." Wait, did I get something wrong there? I believe I got it wrong. I got it a lot wrong. It says, "By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if you have love one to another." Love one to another. Our tongue is in control. The way we view our brothers and sisters is in control, even though we may not be seeing everything exactly eye to eye at a given moment. I'm not advocating that we just keep silent in the face of error or sin that is flagrantly out of character with truth. Brother Anthony shared some illustrations of that. No, we don't. We are here to represent Christ. We are here to be a salt. We are here to be a light. And salt can hurt sometimes as it does its work. I know as a little boy, my mom was pretty faithful getting out the Epsom salts. If I got a splinter in my foot or something, and I know there was just a little bit of fear when I stuck my foot into that bowl of water, how much is going to hurt? Depending on the size of the cut, it could sting a bit. That is the nature of salt. And as we help each other, as we one another each other, there are some times that the truth hurts. The what it takes for us to heal and get on track can hurt a bit. And light is not always appreciated. To people who want a cloak of darkness because of what they're doing, they want to keep it in secrecy. It's not always appreciated for it to be brought to light. But how we apply salt and how we bring things to light makes all the difference. It makes all the difference to a world that's observing us. How we speak and represent Christ is as important as what we speak. Christ's reputation is at stake. Now, our many mediums of communication can make it easier to say things. Maybe say things in ways that we shouldn't because we are not physically facing people. And it's maybe easier to fall into that blunt communication style because we just want to get it said as few words as possible. And get it off our desk, get it out of here, whether it's WhatsApp, email, whatever. And we're not as careful as we should be that it comes through with the right tone. Galatians 5, verse 15 gives us this caution. It says, "But if you bite and devour one another, take heed that you don't consume one another." Now, it can happen in home life. It can happen in extended families, it can happen in churches, and it can happen in nations. That there's biting and devouring until they're consumed. until they're consumed. Maybe some of you know that little jingle about the cats of Kilkenny. There were two cats of Kilkenny. Each thought that there was one cat too many. So they fought and they fit and they scratched and they bit, till accepting their nails and the tips of their tails, instead of two cats, there weren't any. And we can smile at that, but how many times does it really work out that way? Nobody wins because it ended up being a war of words. When our words progress into disagreements and into second-guessing the motives of the other party behind what they're saying and why they're saying it, we're on dangerous soil really fast. Or distorting each other's view, one another's views, personal attacks, we moved into the flesh. That's what we see happening all around us in the political realms. It doesn't belong among the people of God. It doesn't belong there. That's how the name of Jesus can get tarnished real fast. So how do we go about endeavoring to maintain sound doctrine, endeavoring to be a people that has a lot of things that we have to work through to really fulfill the New Testament calling in our life, and yet not look to the world like we're at each other? How do we go about that? I have a few pointers for relation, and I'm thinking primarily about believer to believer. Each of us, as we move about, we are always only a step away. We are always only a step away from a potential landmine, a landmine. You know, it's just the way it works. As we relate to people, we never know how we could impact them. As we endeavor to be helpful, as we endeavor to share, we can step into explosive situations that we didn't even mean it that way. We didn't intend it to be taken that way. But there's these possibilities as we endeavor to live in a close-knit Christian community the way Christ wants us, and we endeavor to be one. There's that possibility that we can always be a step away from some sort of landmine, something that could go wrong if we're not doing it God's way, doing it carefully. The first pointer I have is go to them privately and ask them what they meant by what they said, did, or wrote, or what they allegedly said, did, or wrote. Okay, that was a bit long, but basically, the short version, go to them privately and ask what they meant. Don't tell other people what you think they meant. I think that's a good way to try and stay out of the landmine, so to speak. Jesus advised us as Christians to go to our brother or sister in private. If we have an issue and we're trying to sort things out and it's churning in our heart, well then, let's go and see if our perspective is right. Let's see if we are understanding it right, what they were endeavoring to communicate or whatever. To not sort things out in private usually ends up coming out publicly. It usually ends up coming out that way because we are going to sort it out. And if we don't start with the person that we're struggling with, very likely we're going to go to other people. There's a word that the news media uses very regularly, and it's a word sometimes that maybe we get tired of seeing, and that is the word alleged. Because sometimes it appears to be very, very obvious. And I want to say, why did they put the word alleged in there? Well, they do that to protect themselves legally. That's why they do it. But they do it because while it obviously appears to be the case, it is alleged until it is substantiated. In fact, it is alleged. It's not substantiated yet at the time they're doing the writing. We have these hypotheses in our mind. We have these conclusions, these beliefs that because of all the pieces of the puzzle we're putting together, we all do it. We come up with something that makes sense in our mind, that this is what they were thinking, this is what they were feeling, and this is why they said what they said. And we tend to carry that on to other people without giving them a chance to say, no, wait, Is this correct? Do I have the correct hypothesis here? None of us likes others to define our motives without first trying to understand our heart. Going to our brother or sister directly is a great help in preventing the gossip mill churning that shouldn't be churning, that can spin out of control. Going to the other is really practicing the golden rule. It's what we'd want them to do to us, right? Someone shared an observation on a social media thread that somebody posted something that was built on supposition about somebody else. The entire dialogue was built on what a friend may have meant or didn't mean in what they wrote. Amazingly, no one ever thought to contact their friend privately and ask a few questions that could have salvaged the situation before the carnage even begun. But it resulted in people getting angry at one another, some even blocking the correspondence. And that's a sad day if that kind of thing happens on between Christian people. I had some stressful relationship encounters already in my life, and there's more than one time I was very tempted to put a block. Because after a while, if you feel like you're dealing with irrationality and you feel like it's taking a toll on you, it's very tempting to block. But I'd like to encourage us to be a people that endeavors to reach out to God's grace, endeavors to reach out to God's wisdom, and endeavors to try and relate as civil as we can when we get into some tense things. Number two, when we go to someone privately, ask them questions. Don't make accusations. It's always good to come in a question form. Remember, the reason that we are there is because it's still alleged. It's still a hypothesis, and it's because it's something we heard. It's because of pieces of puzzle that we put together that are causing us a little concern, and that's why we're there. We're there to see if we have any valid grounds on what we heard or what we put together. And again, we have to keep in mind, how would I want to be treated if I was the other person and the concerns were directed toward me? For the most part, in my limited experience at life, I found that there's a lot of accusations that are based on second or third-hand information that are usually inaccurate in some way. In some way, they're inaccurate. Partial truths, often rooted in misunderstandings or biases. And when we open up the conversation as we are holding the truth, and we are coming to them to let them know we're holding the truth, we set ourselves up for a very difficult conversation. We set ourselves up for it to go south. But when we come with questions, we just want to understand if what we have is the truth. You know, if Jesus could be misunderstood, with as a perfect teacher, so much more we can be. Jesus, I'd like to turn to John chapter 21. I'm sorry, it's verse 21. Where was that passage where, well, I'll read here. I don't have the chapter, I apologize. It says, Peter, seeing him, saith to Jesus, Lord, and what shall this man do? Jesus saith unto him, If I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Follow thou me. Then went this saying abroad among the brethren, that the disciple should not die. Yet Jesus said unto him, He shall not die. Jesus said not unto him, He shall not die, but if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? This is that disciple which testified of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. So here's an example where Jesus said something, and it got represented in a way that Jesus wasn't meaning that. Jesus was not meaning that John would not die. Jesus was just trying to help Peter to understand that Jesus is God. And if Jesus has plans for Peter's life and has grace for Peter to go through that, and would have different plans for John, he will give grace for John to go through that. But they somehow took out of what Jesus said that this is how it's going to be. And Jesus wasn't saying that. He was just trying to say, if I would that it would be this way, I'm God. Finally, I'm Lord. Jesus was trying to show that he is divine. And we are called to give our life to his will for our life. Well, if Jesus can be misunderstood, quite obviously there will be times that we will be misunderstood. If people had to come back to Jesus to question if what they're hearing was what he really meant, well, we'll have to do it for sure. We'll for sure have to do it. If they had to do it for Jesus, we'll have to for sure do it. You know, we can take things and get onto wrong trains, on the wrong tracks, and take it as truth and spread it as truth. And with social media, it can spread so, so fast and do so much damage. Let's be very, very careful, people. Number three, do not hold as gospel truth your perspective of another's motives or intention. Do not hold it as gospel truth. It ties right in with number two. While it's fine to question someone's judgment, I mean, that's what we do. We look at things that have happened and we try and piece together. Now, why did this happen? How did they come to that conclusion? It's okay to question someone's judgment, but we need to be very careful in judging their motives and believing that we know what their motives were. The Bible says that love thinks no evil. We're going to assume the best if we truly love each other. We're going to assume the best and we're going to believe that there was some good reason for why they made that call that looks shady or looks less than the best to us. The beauty and upside of a close-knit spiritual family like we enjoy is we learn to know each other well. You know, we're trying to make Christianity practical. We're trying to have something that the world can look at and be in awe at. We're trying to be unified enough that they notice and are in awe. And the upside is there's a close-knit spiritual family. We learn to know each other because we're not just running our own little independent worlds. But the downside of a close-knit spiritual family is we think we know each other so well that we think we know motives and we think we know intentions without even asking them. We just know. We just know them so well. Now, my wife and I have shared our home together for almost 38 years. And we can almost read each other's minds. But you know what? There's times that I think both of us have some big surprises. We didn't quite get it right, even though we think we know each other so well. And congregational life is much less hands-on than home life. We must leave room for our perceptions to be wrong about a brother or sister and their motives and intentions. We must leave room for that to be wrong. We are not inside their head. We do well in many cases to give time for fruit to speak for itself. Fruit usually speaks the intentions. I shouldn't say the intentions, but fruit usually validates a lot of things. I can't say it's not a pear tree if it has a pear on at the end of the day. It is a pear tree. Give fruit time to validate what you might be thinking in your heart, and you might find out you're wrong. Number four, always do our part to slow down the rumor mill instead of helping it along. Always do our part to slow it down, In observing Christian community, someone wrote this observation: I don't believe Christians know what slander or gossip is unless it is happening to them. Unless it is happening to them, they don't seem to know what it is. They mistakenly think that if something is true or half true or could well be true as they know the person, it isn't gossip or slander. Now, I have a couple definitions that I found. What exactly is gossip? I'll share this definition. Gossip is second or third-hand information that someone dumps on you without your prior consent, and without the consent of the person being gossiped about. Gossip can be true, partially true, or completely false. It can be motivated by good intentions, but it's always negative personal information about another that puts them in a bad light. I like that. I thought that's a fairly clear definition of gossip. I found this one for slander. The Bible defines slander as accusatory speech that is injurious to a person's name and reputation. It's essentially character assassination, the act of smearing someone. Gossip and slander color people's perceptions of an individual unfairly and unjustly without their knowledge or consent. One major component in both of these sins is that the person being torn down is out of the loop. Usually they're out of the loop. Slanders usually avoid speaking directly to the one they are demeaning. Gossip and slander violate the basic principle of doing to others as we would want them to do to us. No one wishes to be the subject of gossip or slander. There are a few things that are as hurtful as that. But the problem is, it usually feels so innocent to us. It usually aids us in maybe making conversation or being a hero to someone who now has information they didn't have before and maybe information that they didn't need. I was smitten a bit as I was preparing for this message. Usually God speaks to your heart more than anyone else's as you study to preach. But I had to replay a short conversation I had with a service technician at our shop this past week. He was on hold with tech support, and we were both waiting. And in the process, he tried to make small talk with me as we waited. And he commented about a very, a very high-riding, fashionable, tricked-out pickup that happened to be parked in the shop getting the windows tinted. He commented about that vehicle, and he commented in a way that I could tell that he considered that a off-the-charts vehicle, as I did. And there was something burning inside of me that, because I could tell that we agreed that this vehicle is over and above the norms, I wanted to offer him some more information, and I did. And I told him that he might be surprised to realize that vehicle is driven by someone who he would expect to be driving horse and buggy. And that was eye-opening. He was surprised about that. He said he heard a Rumspringa, but he didn't know that that would include actually buying vehicles. And after the fact, I was like, why? Why did he even need to know that? What did that help him? What did that help the cause of Christ? It gave us something to talk about. It started out with something that we would have both felt at one with. But at the end of the day, it probably made him appreciate the people group less. Was it true? Yeah. Was it surprising? Yeah. Was it that he wouldn't have probably discovered that if he lived in Lancaster and Lebanon County long enough himself? Probably he would have. But at this point, apparently he didn't know that part. And it was just gossip. I had information that he really didn't need to know about. A.W. Tozer had these powerful words of advice about the sin of gossip. Never pass anything about anybody else that will hurt them. 1 Peter 4:8 tells us that love covers a multitude of sins. The talebearer has no place in God's favor. If you know something that would hinder or hurt the reputation of one of God's children, bury it forever. Find a little garden out back, a little spot somewhere. And when somebody comes around with an evil story, take it out and bury it and say, here lies in peace the story about my brother. God will take care of it. If you want God to be good to you, you are going to have to be good to his children. With what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. Bob Mumford said this, the Christian army is the only one that shoots its wounded. We can strive as a Christian community to be doctrinally sound. We can strive to be the greatest evangelists on planet Earth. We can travel to countries on foreign soil. We can travel to cities like New York City and Los Angeles and anything in between. We can pride ourselves in being an organization that disciples people into being like Jesus. But it is true this morning that the tongue is a fire. We can destroy everything we try and do with our tongue and how we use it as we relate to each other. May God help us to live like Jesus as we